This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the payola scandal of the 1950s? Several radio DJs were accused of accepting bribes in return for playing records. Some people went to jail, there was a congressional investigation, and payola seemed to disappear. But in 1986, the NBC Nightly News ran a series of reports on the new payola. Their charges have led to two congressional investigations, a Los Angeles federal grand jury investigation, and several indictments. My guest, Frederick Dannon, has written a new book, Hitmen, about the new payola and other corrupt practices in the rock music industry. According to Dannon, the new payola is different from the payola of the 50s.
What happened is sometime, I think, in 1978, an organization was formed called the Network. The Network consisted of about 6 to 8 key men who were based in different cities in the United States who had carved the country up into personal territories. Your territory consisted of a group of top 40 stations over which you had influence. The record labels were paying you, if you were a member of the Network, anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000 to promote one record. So some of the top members of the Network were making tens of millions of dollars a year. The way that you had control over those stations in many instances was through bribery. You were taking the large sums that the record company was giving you, and you were converting them to cash, which you were paying to program directors at radio stations. Either you were giving them an envelope full of cash, or you were sending them a Federal Express envelope with cocaine, or you were providing them with prostitutes in some cases, you were taking them out. You were giving them some kind of gifts or other form of compensation. But one way or another, you had influence over them.
Why did the record companies, who had their own promotion departments, buy into this independent network of promotion people?
Well, one thing your promotion department couldn't do was to guarantee a specific station with regularity, the way the Network seemed to be able to do. Remember, the top 40, which is the most important format, the one that really breaks pop music, is a very tight format. There are 40 slots, sometimes fewer than 40 slots, and most of that list carries over from week to week. So your local promotion guy simply wasn't going to be able to do the trick with regularity. After all, the record industry releases something like 200 new singles a month, so the competition for a spot on that playlist is absolutely fierce.
So you're suggesting that the independent promotion people could buy their way into the top 40, but the record companies themselves wouldn't feel comfortable having their own promotion department hand over bribes.
They needed the insulation. The Network people, in effect, most of them, were bagmen for the record companies. This was a way for the record companies to deny that they had any knowledge of what was going on if something ever went wrong. In fact, the contracts that they issued to the Network promoters contained a clause that forbade them to give payola, which is interesting in itself when you think about it, why that clause should even have even been necessary. But the record companies could just, and would periodically, when questioned about them, say, "I don't know how he does it, but he's very effective."
What forms did the bribery take? Was it always just literally giving people cash in an envelope, or drugs in an envelope, or were there other more insulated forms of bribery?
It varied. For example, Joe Isgro, who was one of the key members of the Network, goes on trial August 14th in Los Angeles in what's going to be the biggest payola case ever tried. He was indicted on 51 counts, including not only payola but drug trafficking. His top lieutenants, Ralph Tashchin and Bill Craig, were convicted already. I'm not saying Isgro's going to be convicted, but they pleaded guilty. And they confessed, among other things, to sending cocaine to program directors in Federal Express pouches. One program director I'm aware of used to get a weekly birthday card. He would go to a post office box that had been set up for him by the independent promoter, by the Network man, and every week he would get a birthday card brimming with $50 and $100 bills. Sometimes they would send empty cassette boxes with money stuffed in them. One program director would hold a sleeve of a 45 up to his ear that contained cash and shake it and say, "Sounds good." These are some of the stories of which I've been made aware. There probably were other methods.
What about methods like hiring a program director as a consultant and for not really doing any work and therefore giving them a lot of money, but on paper it looks like it's a service that's being performed. It's not a bribe.
Well, this was the biggest problem that the system had, apart from the sheer illegality of it. You could not be absolutely certain that the record you were paying all this money for was even being played. Because since there was this relationship between the network promoter and the program director, and let me clarify that. The program director is the person at a radio station who makes up the playlist. So that is the person you want to influence. Since there was this relationship between the network promoter and the program director, if you had an arrangement whereby the network man was going to be paid a bonus for landing a specific station, the only way that you could tell whether the station was, in fact, playing your song was through a publication called Radio and Records, the industry's leading tip sheet. So all the program director had to do, he didn't even have to play the record. He could just lie to Radio and Records, tell the magazine he was playing the song. And this was known as the paper ad. Paper ads began to flourish right around the time the network was formed.
Did the record companies basically start this network of independent promotion people?
It's hard to say exactly. I think what happened is that certain key guys, and some of them, by the way, had mob ties, were just aggressive about developing control over certain key stations. I think there actually was this meeting. It's I've heard a number of people discuss it in 1978. At which some of the most powerful consultants got together and formed this cartel. It was actually an alliance in the sense that everyone knew who had what station. And on occasion, if one network man tried to poach on another network man's territory, there could be bloodshed.
In your book, Hitmen, you suggest that one of the things that was in it for the record companies to go through these independent promotion men was that if you had to buy your way onto the playlist, the major labels could do it, the independent labels couldn't. So this was a way for the major labels to eliminate the independent labels as competition.
Absolutely right. And in fact, around 1978, when the network was formed, you began to see independent labels disappear from the top 40 charts. It was only in 1986, after the record industry temporarily started to boycott the network after it had become much too expensive, that a small independent label like Profile Records was able to get a single in the top 40. If you were to try and promote legitimately and just depend on free market forces, you would often lose out to an independent label because the independent label had a better song.
But why couldn't if you were a major label, your promotion department had much more muscle than any independent label promotion department ever could.
I know, but if they had the better product, what were you going to do? If the radio station started playing it, well, for example, rap has come out of the independent labels. Rap is now very big. Profile Records came out with Run DMC, and it was unstoppable. The market wanted it. It's almost always been the small independent labels that have come up with the new styles. The major labels tend to imitate each other and to latch onto fads. Disco also started with the independent labels. Rock and roll, for that matter, back in the 50s, came out of small independent labels like Chess and Specialty and Dot. It wasn't coming out of Capitol. Capitol was, or CBS for that matter. CBS was putting out Doris Day and Ray Conniff at the time that Chess was putting out Chuck Berry.
How did the network, this small group of independent promotion men, come to dominate the record industry that had created it?
Well, the dominance came through fear. As I said earlier, their power was not to make a hit record, it was to prevent one. And the story that opens Hitmen, of course, is that of Pink Floyd. They had the number one album at the time, The Wall. This was early 1980. They were performing in Los Angeles at the Sports Arena, which held 16,000 people. They had it booked for five consecutive nights. And yet, at that time, not one top 40 station in Los Angeles would play the single from that album, Another Brick in the Wall, because CBS Records was experimentally boycotting the network in that region for that one song. Well, CBS Records got a very dramatic lesson in the power of the network. And remember, this was 1980. The power of the network hadn't even peaked. It was only really about 2 years old at that point. But the day that Dick Asher, the deputy president of CBS Records, finally relented and agreed to allow the network to be paid for promoting that single, it was on three of the four biggest top 40 stations that day in Los Angeles.
So the network had the power to...
To prevent a record.
To tell stations to not play a record as well as to suggest that they play it?
That was the source of their power. They really couldn't make a hit record. Only the market can really do that. You can saturate the airwaves with an uncommercial song and have some moderate success. But in the end, if it's going to be a hit record, it has to be in the grooves, as they say in the industry. I'll give you some examples, or one good example. Carly Simon's single, Jesse. Warner Brothers paid, I've been told, $300,000 in independent promotion fees to get that on the radio. And it went top 10, but nobody bought the album. Nobody really wanted it. There were recent singles by two groups on Virgin, Tapao and Cutting Crew, that went top 5, and their albums were stiffs. The real power these guys had was that they could keep a record from being played. That enabled the major record companies, the six big companies, CBS, MCA, Warner, Capitol, Bertelsmann Music Group, and Polygram, to have a virtual chokehold on top 40 radio at the expense of the independents.
How could the independent promoters prevent a record from being played?
Well, they would go to the program director over whom they had influence. And remember, if you're feeding someone's cocaine habit, you have a lot of influence over that person. You would go to the program director and say, don't play this single. It was as simple as that.
I guess one of the things that confuses me about the power that you say these independent promotion men had, it would make it seem as if every program director, every music director at a top 40 station was a cocaine addict or was corrupt enough to accept pay for play.
They didn't all have to be. To get a single on the charts in Billboard, you need to get a certain number of key stations. What you usually did was you would turn to the leading record industry tip sheet, which is radio and records, and look at their top 40 survey. They basically polled 200 key stations around the country to make up their charts. So for starters, you could ignore any station that wasn't on the radio and record survey. If you wanted to get your single on the charts, you just had to concentrate on the stations that were being used by radio and records. Then you only had to get a certain percentage of those stations in order to get a chart position. And that's where all the concentration was placed. I mean, this is one of the ironies of the network. You could have a single that was on the charts as top 5 or top 10, and nobody was really buying it, or not enough people were buying it to justify it being there.
The current FCC payola rules were basically written after the 60s payola scandals. And since that kind of payola is different from the kind of payola that's developed since, are the current payola prohibitions the right ones to prohibit what's been happening in the 80s?
No, absolutely not. They're absolutely outdated. First of all, the maximum penalty under that congressional statute of 1960 for payola, for starters, it's a misdemeanor. The maximum penalty is 1 year in jail and a fine of $10,000. To date, absolutely no one has served a day in jail for payola. Kenny Gamble, who was probably the first person convicted under that statute, Kenny Gamble was the Philadelphia record producer responsible or partly responsible for such groups as Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and the OJs, was convicted under that statute in 1975 or 76, and he was fined $2,500. That was his punishment. So it's a toothless statute, and the FCC, of course, is not really an enforcement agency. It's not like the SEC. The SEC was able to mount a very effective campaign against insider trading, And we've been able to see the deterrent effect of that already. It's had an impact. Unless Joe Isgro is convicted, or if he is willing to, or willing and able to turn evidence against record industry figures, that is, executives in major record companies, I don't think there is any deterrent. You know, the network, to quote a Talking Heads song, it's the same as it ever was. It's back. They were gone for a while after that NBC News report in 1986. But apart from Isgro, who has his legal problems, the same players are back doing the same things.
Do the major record companies still use independent promotion people now?
They do, but they've got the last laugh. What happened is, before early 1986, when that NBC News report showing two of the top members of the network meeting with John Gotti of the Gambino family was aired, the record companies were spending this $60 to $80 million on independent promotion themselves out of their own budgets. What happened after that report, when the labels started to boycott the network, the artists were so, and their managers, were so insistent on having the support of independent promotion that they began to pay for independent promotion out of their own pockets. Today, a typical arrangement would be for the record company, the major record company, to pay out money to an artist in the guise of something else, say tour support. And that money is actually being used for independent promotion. So there's yet another layer separating the record company from the bribery. It's terrific. Before, the record company would pay the network man would do the dirty work. Now it's even better. You pay the artist manager. The artist manager pays the network man. But what makes it a victory for the record companies is that because of the way the payments are doled out, they're recoupable. In other words, they can be charged against the artist's royalties, and they are. So what's happened is it still exists, but the artists are paying for it.
And the independent promotion people are still as corrupt, even after all the investigations and prosecutions?
Sure. I mean, this is a rogue industry. People seem to be amazed at the amount of corruption that's been unearthed on Wall Street. I'm not. I mean, I covered Wall Street, and Wall Street has a lot in common with the record industry. Wall Street's very deal-driven. The record industry is totally hit-driven. When your motto is whatever it takes, and you mean exactly that, then you really don't have a sense of limits. I think that's something those two businesses have in common, no sense of limits.
As of 1989, you say that the control of nearly 90% of the record industry is in the hands of six multinationals. So the six major labels are CBS, Warner, PolyGram, MCA, Capitol, and RCA Arista.
Well, actually, the sixth major label is known as BMG, for Bertelsmann Music Group. Bertelsmann is a West German company that bought RCA Records from RCA and Arista Records, which is the home of Whitney Houston.
If most of the power is in the hands of six companies, how does that affect what gets produced now?
Well, look at it like this. Say you are an artist and you have a demo tape and you want to get a record deal. 15 or 20 years ago, there were 25, 30 places to shop that tape. Now your attorney or your manager is shopping that tape to the six biggest record companies. It's true you could get a deal with an independent label like A&M, but who owns A&M? PolyGram. Or with Def Jam, but who owns Def Jam? CBS. Or with Motown, but who owns Motown? MCA. So what's happened is you really have six players, and it's an oligopoly in the true sense, because the retailers, the record stores, the rack jobbers, they're buying all of their product from six companies, all, virtually all, because those companies either are recording you or, at the very least, they're distributing you. So that means that if they don't like you, if they don't like your music, they don't feel that you have a shot, they don't distribute you, you don't get shelf space, you have no career.
Now, you also say that under today's system, only superstars who sell millions of records can make a reasonable return. But the way that contracts are structured, the record company can make a profit off an album while the artist's royalty account is still in the red. How can that be?
Record company contracts are an absolute abomination. any time that an artist has sued and a judge has taken a look at a record contract, the case has been settled or the artist has won, because they are really contracts of adhesion, which is a polite way of saying slave labor. Absolutely everything, and I mean everything, every expense is chargeable against the artist's royalties. If Random House came to me and they said, Fred, your book's doing very well, but you know that the cost of paper and binding and advertising, that's all coming out of your royalties, so I don't think you're going to be getting a check from us. I would be appalled. And yet that is what artists have to deal with. You have to sell, you literally just about have to have a platinum album that is 1 million copies to make any money, any serious money off an album. And even then, sometimes you don't. Patti Smythe and Warrior had a platinum album in 1985, and they made about 10 cents a record off of that.
So what are some of the expenses that are usually charged against artist royalties?
Well, now independent promotion, which is a major expense. You could say the artists are to blame for that, but I don't know that they are. It's a system that the industry created. Another big expense is touring. The cost of making a video is a major expense. You can easily spend six figures, high six figures, making a music video. And they're considered de rigueur now. I think videos are overdone. They're more appropriate for certain types of artists than others. But the labels just keep churning them out.
What was your method of investigating the record industry?
What I tried to do was make myself very visible to the industry and very familiar so that they would start to think of me as a quasi-insider, as if I were writing for Billboard or Variety. What I did first was go to a lot of the record industry conventions. And I also tried to cultivate, to use a term in the industry, rabbis, that is, people who were very well connected, who took a liking to me and would introduce me to other people. One thing I'm very proud of is that something like 90% of Hitman is on the record. I guess what happened is that people did get used to having me around, and I got them to relax, and they told me stories that were generally well known in the industry, but no one had ever published, and I suppose they expected that I wouldn't publish them.
Do you have any predictions where the next scandal will come from within the music industry?
I have a feeling that this ISGRO matter is going to burgeon and lead to cases involving kickbacks. ISGRO is in a position, if he desires, to, I believe, take down executives of the record industry with him, because he is believed to have paid kickbacks to many. And in fact, one person he's alleged to have paid kickbacks to, Ray Anderson, the former head of Epic, Michael Jackson's label, goes on trial with ISGRO on August 14th.
Frederick Denon's new book is Hitmen, Power Brokers and Fast Money Inside the Music Business. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.